not an old man's game, it's a young man's game, and we are hiring people as rapidly as we can.
This is Horizons of Science, an exploration of the world of electronics, examining the now and the tomorrow of this exciting field. What impact does it have on your everyday life? Let's find out on this edition, The Age of Jetomation. To some, modern air transportation is the curse of noisy jets thundering over residential areas. To others, a crowded airport, or perhaps a friendly smile from a stewardess. But obviously, there's more to the sleek, graceful birds that rush thousands of passengers around the world daily. And something new may not give the stewardess reassuring smile, but it's proving to be just that helpful. It's an automatic landing device. It does just that. Lands a giant jetliner without a pilot. Oh, the pilot is still there. But for a more precise picture of what an automatic landing device is and what it does, let's talk long distance to Will Brown. He's chief assistant pilot for Pan American's training division at the East Coast. Will, tell us about the automatic landing device.
Well, it involves now coupling the airplane to the flight control surfaces by electronic means to enable the airplane to be positioned automatically by these computers and radio signals from the ground to an electronic beam and fly the airplane completely automatic to the runway.
Now, that in a nutshell is how the auto landing device works. You may have heard or read about a recent demonstration by Pan American Airways for a group of newsmen and technical reporters. Will Brown fills us in on the activities of that day.
We had quite a number of people on board to observe this operation, which we did quite a few approaches at the Milwaukee Airport. And incidentally, that day turned out to be quite a bad day for weather. The ceiling kept getting lower and lower in the rain and so on, so it actually was a good demonstration of the airplane being put through an automatic landing in a real weather situation. There we demonstrated the actual locking on to the ILS. Now the ILS is, of course, the instrument landing system, which is a high frequency radio beam projected in space. It's line of sight and it's accurately calibrated to be in alignment with a runway and also gives glide path direction. We coupled the airplane through the computers and engaged this beam, configured the airplane, and then using the programming that we put into the computer for the coupler and the automatic throttles, proceeded to fly the airplane down to the ground.
Now, this was with no hands, right?
Hands off. Completely hands off.
Well, for the public anyway, the novelty of this auto landing device has not worn off. Is it being used commercially today to any degree?
Well, it is not in common use today, Lyle. It's in limited use in those areas such as Pan American is doing right now. Perhaps other carriers are. I know of at least one British outfit that is using it in limited operational use today, to gain experience, expose it to the crews for operational use and their own familiarization and confidence building that the equipment really does work. We use it operationally in Pan American to existing minima at airports. And the way this works is that the pilot will engage the coupler and make an automatic approach with the intent that he will land automatically, and at his decision height for that airport, which may be 200 feet or 300 feet, depending on the airport, At that point, if every part of the system is working well, and he can see the runway to land in accordance with the minima for that runway, he will then continue fully automatic and make the landing.
Will Brown, how many of these automated landings have been made?
We've made several hundreds of these in line operations with passengers on board.
From past programs on Horizons of Science, we find mixed emotions from people to new devices and methods. Is there any objection expressed or implied by the pilots themselves to having a machine do their work for them?
Well, in our own company, Lyle, our pilots react quite favorably to these automatic systems because we have been dealing with automatic couplers now for several years, and the pilot is quite familiar with the controls operating through an electronic computer where he simply rides lightly on the control as a monitor, as a human monitor. And the addition now is that he has automatic throttles to work for him. So I would say that our people are learning very fast on how to use this equipment, and they feel quite at home with it. Initially, yes, everyone feels a little bit strange with a control wheel moving under his hands and the throttles moving automatically. There is that desire to make inputs, but he soon learns that the automatic equipment is functioning correctly. The inputs are correct. He needs only monitor. And this is the confidence building factor that we strive towards when we train a man to use this equipment.
Well, let's come down to earth, either automatically or manually, and discuss automation being used in another facet of air travel. We know that there are more and more commercial flights every day, and yet the passenger miles flown make it the safest means of travel. We owe that safety to the airlines and their competent, experienced pilots and mechanics, of course, but more also to the men and machines who control the flights from the ground, the air traffic controllers. Here also, automation is coming into its own. Chuck Irwin, head of the Chicago Air Traffic Control Center, situated near Aurora, Illinois, tells us how automation is being used on the ground to facilitate the heavy load of air traffic.
The system that we are putting in now at Chicago Center is part of the National Airspace System that is being used by the Federal Aviation Administration. And the particular system at Chicago involves installing a rather large digital computer known as an IBM 9020, which has great capacity and is a series of IBM 360 computers linked together. And we hope to and plan to control air traffic in the future beyond 1972 using digitized radar data as well as other digitized data presented to the controller.
Chuck, I understand your air traffic control center has jurisdiction over the upper Midwest from Omaha to Ohio. How will your system function when the computer system is in operation?
To begin with, you have to visualize radar sites remotely located from our position here in Aurora. At these radar sites, we would have what are known as common digitizers that would take raw radar data, convert it into digital form, transmit it to the Chicago Center located in Aurora over telephone lines into a digital computer, which would interpret the information and then present it to an air traffic controller on a scope in a coded form.
Chuck Irwin, question. Will this computer system finally push man out of the air traffic control position?
Well, it certainly will not eliminate them. We are hopeful that the use of digitized radar and the other electronic aids that will be provided by the computer will help the controller be more productive by doing some of the bookkeeping work that he now has to do. For example, the air traffic controller now has to dig up a small plastic chip and place it on a radar scope over the top of a particular target, and then he has to push this chip along with the radar target. We hope that with the digitized data, when we have an electronic tag that is produced automatically, that this will let the controller devote more of his time to applying separation standards, which in the end should let him be more productive with the digitized equipment.
We'll be talking more to Chuck Irwin, our air traffic control expert, and to Will Brown from Pan Am about automation and electronics in the jet age. But let's explore another aspect of electronics and its application to transportation. There's a company in Chicago called Magnaflux. It deals with testing materials and components of, well, nearly everything. I talked with Tracy McFarlane, the products manager for one of the divisions of Magnaflux, about NDT, non-destructive testing, which is just about what it means, testing without harming the part being tested. Tracy McFarland, what are the different types of non-destructive testing in common use today, and how does each system work?
First, and probably most important for our company, is the magnetic particle method. And this involves magnetizing a part that is to be inspected for surface discontinuities. The magnetic field will follow the bunch up around a defect that is on the surface of the part. Magnetic particles of ion, usually small ion particles, are sprinkled over the surface of the part. All these particles may be in a liquid form, and when they gather around the defect, the surface defect, you can see them either visually or under a black light or ultraviolet light condition. The other method that we use for materials that cannot be magnetized, such as aluminum, is the penetrant method. And this simply means that a penetrant material is placed on the surface of the part to be inspected, and a developer is placed on the surface of the material after certain operations, and then the penetrant actually bleeds out of the defect into the developer, and you can readily see where the surface discontinuity is. Those two methods are essentially used for finding surface defects. There are two other methods, both of them electronic. One of them is called ultrasonics, and its primary purpose in life is to find internal defects. To do this, we propagate sound energy into the material to be tested. The sound energy goes in and hits the defects that are inside, and these defects reflect the sound back to the transducing element. And then information is read out either on a cathode ray tube or by lighting a light or ringing a bell. The fourth method is what we call eddy current, and this too is a means of inspecting the surface of a material for defects, and it can also be used for sorting purposes, sorting out different types of materials. It's a rapid method, it's an electronic method, and again, we get rapid readout of information, very similar to what we are able to obtain with the ultrasonic techniques.
Tracy, which industries utilize non-destructive testing?
Well, there are many industries that are utilizing our methods and our test equipment. There are, I would say, some major ones, one being the aerospace industry, which is a big one for us. Second one is the primary metal industry, and this includes the steel industry, as well as the primary metal industries, are involved with making aluminum and making of brass and copper products. We also do quite a bit of business and work with the railroad industry, the petroleum and the chemical industry, to mention just a few. We're as you may well imagine, non-destructive testing equipment has a very broad application across a very, very broad industrial board. But those, I think, are the big ones that we are concerned with at the moment.
Let's look closer at non-destructive testing in the aerospace industry. How does it fit into the massive technology of design and fabrication that goes into, say, a plane like the SST, the supersonic transport?
Yes, we have been involved in the aerospace industry for a long time, and in the area of the SST, of course, this is basically an aircraft that is somewhat similar in construction to aircraft that have been made for many years. The only difference is that it flies faster and at higher elevations than aircraft prior to this time. And of course, because of its tremendous speed and the weight of this airplane, well, the components that make up the airplane are subjected to very severe stress conditions or loads. And therefore, the components that make up the aircraft must be free of discontinuities. And it's quite apparent that if this is the case, why non-destructive testing would play a very important part. And I would say that most of the methods that we are currently involved with, the four that I previously mentioned, are used to inspect the critical components on aircraft such as the SST. Now, this might involve components such as the wheel of the aircraft, the landing gear assembly, which obviously is subjected to very high loads, particularly when landing, of course. The wing structure, the spars that hold the wings on the airplane, the tail sections of the airplane, all of these parts must be inspected and inspected quite thoroughly. They are tested way back in the manufacturing cycles in the mills, and then again at the aircraft plant and during the process of manufacture, these parts are inspected. And then even after they are assembled into the airplane and the airplane is put into service, there is a continual check of these critical components to be sure that they're going to hold together under service conditions. So when people fly in an airplane today, they can be sure that non-destructive testing has played a very important part of keeping that airplane up in the air and making it a safe and reliable transportation vehicle.
Tracy McFarland, how do you visualize NDT, non-destructive testing, being used in the future, not only for transportation in its final form, but during the whole process?
Well, we are always exploring new areas of non-destructive testing. As an example, microwave is one area that is coming into being rather rapidly. This is a means of looking inside of and looking at the surface of non-metallic materials. Holography is another technique that can be used for three-dimensional readout of information. But I would say that our primary interest is in utilizing the well-known techniques, the well-known methods that we've been discussing, and improving these methods, doing a more thorough job, finding, if necessary, smaller discontinuities, maybe utilizing some of these methods for determining physical properties of the materials, and this, of course, gets away from the defect detection, and doing some of these test performances much more rapidly, putting them into a production line so that we can test materials and keep up with the production activity of a plant. A typical case of this, I think, would be in the automotive industry, where production is at a very high rate, and there's certainly a very distinct need for non-destructive testing to test components that make up an automobile, and they must be tested fast, and reliability must be excellent, and so our emphasis is in doing this kind of job.
Well, now that we know more about the behind-the-scenes work that makes every plane, train, and car ride safer for you through non-destructive testing, let's talk about the safety of one of our earlier topics, the automatic landing of jetliners. Will Brown from Pan American, is it possible we've become too enamored with this new gadget that we may be overlooking some disadvantages?
Well, I really haven't seen any disadvantage. It's all been a very welcome piece of equipment to all of us who have been working with it. Certainly it can have malfunction, but we have warnings and monitor systems which are electronic that tell us of malfunctions. And it is so designed that should we have a malfunction, it in no way disturbs the airplane's flight characteristics or its progress towards the runway. We call this a fail-passive system. In other words, if we would have a malfunction, it would disconnect the coupler, a light would come on, and in essence it tells the pilot, I've had it, you take over and finish the job. The pilot then can elect to either continue manually or pull up and go to another airport or take another crack at that particular approach. The system also is designed to prevent any hard over positioning of any control surface. It has limitations as to how much activity can put into the control. So I would say that I really can't put my finger on any disadvantage insofar as we have these built-in safety checks.
Will, where do we go from here? What's in the future for automatic landing devices in air travel?
I would say that very definitely this will become modus operandi for the bulk of the big carrier operations, because this equipment is designed to increase the reliability of schedules, delivering the airplane to its destination with greater reliability under reduced weather conditions. So I'd say it's very much in the future for normal operations.
Let's take this automatic air travel thing a little farther by listening to Chuck Irwin, head of the Air Traffic Control Center near Chicago.
Well, in my opinion, the day will probably come when the computer on the ground will be talking to an airborne computer and, in effect, providing instructions through a digital form and through gauge readouts or dial readouts to a pilot in the air, whether he should climb or whether he should descend, turn left, turn right, and so forth. The computers can be set up to provide what we call conflict detection. When they receive returns that are within a certain number of miles, they could issue instructions to another computer for an aircraft to do something, make a turn or climb or descend, and so forth. So, in my opinion at least, there will be some application of a ground computer to airborne computer and vice versa as we progress into this. I think this is many years off right now, but I think eventually we will get to this, and the supersonic transport may perhaps hasten the day when we see this in actual practice.
Chuck, we spend a lot of time on the show talking about the new gadgets man has made to work easier. But we don't spend much time talking about man. Is there any truth to what we hear about the job longevity for air traffic controllers, that it's so demanding of a job that man loses his touch for it in a few years?
The job itself does entail accepting a great deal of responsibility. It is nerve-wracking at times. It does require intense concentration and so forth. However, it's interesting to note that we do have controllers all the way from age 21 clear up to age 55. They're fully active controllers and doing the full air traffic control job. Some people are affected more than others. We do find that some people cannot progress in air traffic control because they simply don't think fast enough or something like this. But this is very definitely the minority. The majority of the people have no difficulty in controlling the traffic up to age 55. But a person does slow down because of the normal human body deterioration, and he doesn't do things quite as fast as he gets older. This is a thing I'm sure that you have heard about, and it's not an old man's game, it's a young man's game. There's no doubt of this. However, they do have retirement benefits at age 55 with 30-year service. It's an optional type thing, but a person can take it at that age if he so desires.
Well, with that rumor dispelled, what does air traffic controlling offer in the way of job opportunities for the young people of today, say, right now or in the near future?
Well, at the present time, there's a tremendous opportunity in the field of air traffic control. It is growing at an alarming rate. Air traffic is double or triple what it was 3 years ago. And, of course, we are in great need of people. At the present time, we here at Chicago have vacancies amounting to approximately 140. And we are hiring people as rapidly as we can.
Thank you, Chuck Irwin. And I think that expression of job opportunities with the FAA sets the whole stage for a young man or woman today and in the years to come. New ideas being developed and put to use not to complicate our life, but to make it easier. The extent, however, by which it is made easier or simpler is to the extent of your or my understanding. I hope today's show on Horizons of Science, The Age of Jetomation, has brought understanding in the areas of automatic landing devices for jet planes, computerized air traffic control, and non-destructive testing of today's new machines. Horizons of Science was brought to you as a public service of this station and DeVry Institute of Technology, one of the Bell and Howell schools. Lyle Dean, reporting this edition, The Age of Jetomation.